Good evening. I am excited about tonight's message because I'm going to be bringing to you some ideas and some thoughts that have been growing in importance in my soul that I've begun to be passionate about. And so I'm going to be bringing a burden that God has given me, and I want to share that burden with y'all. And some of this sermon is going to, most of the sermon is going to have a kind of negative aspect to it, in that we're going to be talking about some problems. But I don't want you to go away here feeling like you've had a negative sermon. Rather, I am convinced that if I can pass off something of my burden, something of my passion to y'all, I think that it will have an uplifting and positive effect. So I am encouraged about this topic, and I'm excited to be able to bring it to us. Now, because I do have a lot of background material, and a lot of this is going to be new for us, I felt it would be helpful for us to have a visual aid. And so tonight we're going to use the overhead with this sermon. And I'm doing this because I want to be helpful. And I think that this, with this particular material, this is the most effective way to communicate this. So I hope it helps. I hope you find it helpful. Tonight, we'll be talking about the Pharisees. The Pharisees. That group of religious Jews that all four of our Gospels tell us were the enemies of Jesus. Jesus showed himself to be meek and kind and gentle and patient and understanding and tender with all kinds of people, except for one. He showed little to no patience with the Pharisees. I mean, look at the kind of things that he called them to their face. He said, "You guys are offspring of vipers, evil men who bring forth evil things. You're an evil and adulterous generation. You're a wicked generation. You got an unclean spirit. You're hypocrites, blind leaders of the blind. You're sons of hell." Now, that's pretty harsh. "Blind guides, fools, and whitewashed tombs." Now, this is scathing rebuke, isn't it? I mean, this is a declaration of war. And on several occasions, Jesus makes it crystal clear that Pharisees, they don't go to heaven. Those who are like them, those who follow them, those who have made who have followed in their footsteps, they have no part in Jesus' kingdom. My question is why? Why is Jesus so severe with this group of people? And so this has been a question that I've been having and that I've been working on over the past few years. What exactly went wrong with pious Judaism of the first century, and especially the Pharisees? What was their problem? I mean, really, if you get down to the root matter, because there was a lot of things they got wrong and a lot of things we could talk about, but I'm interested in what the core problem was. Now, before we start to answer that, it's important to first ask ourselves why in the world we're doing this. I mean, why should I care about some crazy religious group that's been extinct for 2,000 years? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, they help us to understand our New Testament. They form the backdrop to much of both Jesus as well as Paul. But the reason that I'm bringing them to us tonight is because the Pharisees also help us to understand ourselves. You see, I am convinced that each and every one of us, without exception, perhaps me and more than anyone else here, but we all have a little bit of Pharisee in us. A little bit of Pharisee still clinging to us. Have you ever thought and asked yourselves, why does the New Testament devote so much space in the Gospels to this weird religious group? I mean, by the time the Gospels are written, I mean, they're just a couple of years away from being extinct. And when John wrote his Gospel, the Pharisees have been history for 30 years. So what's the point of devoting so much attention and space to dealing with them? Do you think maybe that God has something for us to learn from them? That maybe that there's something that God knew, there's something about the Pharisees, something that made them tick. Something that made them tick that isn't going to be limited to them. Something about them that the church would have to face someday. This is something that has threatened at different levels, different occasions, different degrees, has threatened our forefathers. This is something that will threaten our children. And this is something that threatens us. We study the Pharisees so that we can identify the core problem that they had, so that we can see it in ourselves, so that we can get about the work of killing it. And if we do that, if God can help us to get rid of some of the remaining residual pockets of Phariseeism that still might be lodged within, I am convinced that we will live a more joyful, more effective, happier Christian life, and God will receive better worship and better service from us than he ever has before. And I find that exciting. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, my sermon has three parts to it. First, we're going to look very briefly at their history. Where did they come from? What was their origin? And then we're going to spend a good deal of time looking at their main ideas. What was it that the Pharisees were all about? What was their agenda? And finally, we're going to take up the words of Jesus, and we're going to try to answer the question, what went wrong? Where did they go wrong? Okay, that's the goal of this sermon. Try to figure out where they went wrong. Well, beginning then with their history. 200 years before Jesus was born, Jerusalem was a mess. I mean, the Greeks had been running the country for well over a century, and with the Greek language came not only the language, but Greek culture, Greek thought, Greek values, Greek athletic games, Greek, you name it. And Greek ways were becoming the cool thing. This was the cultured thing. And more Jews began to be ashamed of their Jewishness. They felt they were part of a primitive culture, and these cultured Greeks, well, this was exciting. This was the end thing. And so more and more Jews began to adopt this new progressive Greek way of life. They stopped tithing. They stopped observing the Sabbath day. Some of them stopped circumcising their children. They wanted them to be able to participate in the Greek games, which were held in the nude. They stopped eating. They started eating Greek food. They started intermarrying with Gentiles, and on and on. They were being assimilated into the Jewish, into the Greek culture, and they were losing their Jewishness. This was a time of rampant religious decline. Biblical religion in 200 BC to the middle of the second century BC, those 50 years in there, was on major downhill declension. It was fast disappearing from Israel. Now, when you have a religious decline like this, if you give long enough period, it goes on long enough, what can you expect to eventually happen by the grace of God? Somebody starts a reformation. You see, not everybody had apostatized. There were still a sizable number of Jews, in fact, that were devout. They were devoted to the religion and customs of their ancestors. They were devoted to the scriptures. And they didn't like at all what they were seeing around them. This horrified them. And so these pious ones, that's what they called themselves, they stood up and they took a firm stance against the erosion of Judaism that was happening around them. That stance cost some of them their lives. And in fact, it got to one point that they actually took up arms against their Greek rulers and went to war with them. And guess what? They won. The Jewish reformers defeated, militarily defeated their Greek rulers. And in so doing, they purged the land. They put to death many of the apostate Jews that had compromised with Greek ways. And they turned the culture wars around the other way. No more would Greek ways dominate in Israel. Judaism had been saved. This was a glorious time for them. This is what the Hanukkah celebration is all about. But once the goal is achieved, once the reformers have got what they were after, what do you suppose happened after not too many years? What always happens? They start fighting amongst themselves, and sooner or not, you got them splitting up into different groups. And the different groups were in disagreement as to how far to take the reform. How much do we reform? How much Jewishness do we need to hold on to, and to what degree? And so you get three major groups. There was probably more than this, but this is the three that has been passed down to us from historical sources, so these are what we know about. And on the left-hand side here, you have ultra-liberals, those who don't want very much reform at all. They want to be Jewish, right? They want a circumcision, priesthood, it's all good. But, you know, I want to have my goods and enjoy life. On this hand, over here, you have the ultra-conservatives, and these guys are fanatics. These guys are, you know, basically almost like medieval monks. They're so serious about being holy and separate and denying themselves and so forth and so on. The Pharisees, believe it or not, were not the most extreme group in Israel at this period in history. They tried to take the middle road. They weren't so as conservative as the Essenes, though they were more closer to them than the Sadducees, but they were miles away from these liberal Sadducees. So you have these three groups. Now, I want us to take one more moment and just look at this list up at the top, those 3 points. You have religious decline in a majority religious culture, followed by a reform movement that arises and stands for biblical values and traditional piety, which eventually splinters over how far to take the reform and ends up with multiple groups and denominations. Now, if I could ask questions, I would ask David Scott. What does this remind us of? What does this look like? Does any of this look familiar to us? Looks to me like the history of virtually every pietistic reform movement in the history of the Christian church. You could say the same thing about the German Anabaptists, the English Puritans, about the Wesleyans, and even about American Reformed Baptists. This is what happens when you have Reformed. And by the way, this is a good thing. I mean, religious decline has to be resisted. Reform movements are essential to keeping true religion alive on the earth. This is good. I just want us to recognize that the Pharisees, too, played a part in this history of reform movements. You see, we need to be honest enough to recognize and to admit the similarity in how we got started and how they got started. And the reason that's important is because if we share a similar historical genesis, could it be that maybe some of the things they struggled with, some of the things that threatened them, some of the traps maybe that they fell into, might become threats to us as well? I think so. Well, the Pharisees were involved in politics early on. Back then, religion and politics wasn't two different things. So they tried to run things, and for a few short years, under a Jewish queen in the middle of the first century BC, they got lots of power. And the Pharisees virtually ran the internal affairs of the country. But that didn't last long. The queen died, and they fell out of favor. And then the Romans came in very shortly thereafter, and the Romans didn't trust the Pharisees. Too fanatic for them. And so the Pharisees were never able to regain the political clout that they'd once had. They never quite lost interest in politics, but they were out of power, couldn't be effective there very much, though there were always Pharisees somewhere up in different halls of power. And so what they did is they turned their attention to what they could influence, the people. Can't run the government, but what we can do is push our religious and social reforms at the popular level. And that's something they did very effectively, using the synagogue. They basically, they might have even originated the synagogue, we don't really know. But they certainly dominated the synagogues of Israel at this time period. And through the synagogues, they pushed their reforms, and they were mightily effective in doing so, and they were so effective that the people absolutely gravitated and latched onto them. The common people in Israel, they gained their ear and their heart, so that by the time you get to Jesus, the Pharisees are the undisputed masters of popular religion in Israel. You want to know what to think about religion? You want to know how to act and be a good Jew? Everyone says, well, you go ask the Pharisees. They're the ones teaching in our synagogues that we go to every single Sabbath. They had the Jewish people in the palm of their hands, and boy, did they enjoy that. And that's one of the reasons why they didn't like Jesus very much. Because amongst other things, Jesus was a threat to their popularity and their control of the people. People were flocking to Jesus to listen to him, and they weren't flocking to them anymore. And that made them green with jealousy, and so they were vitally instrumental in getting Jesus crucified. We know about that from our Gospels. And that was the biggest mistake they ever made. because God would punish them for that. And with them, he would punish the entire nation. And 30 years later, in AD 70, the Roman army crushed a Jewish rebellion, swept into Jerusalem, leveled the temple to the ground, massacred the Jews, and put an end to Judaism as it was then known. That was the end of the Pharisees, the end of the Sadducees, the end of the priests, the end of a whole way of life. Well, that's their history. Let's take a look now at their main ideas. What was the Pharisees' agenda? So if you go into their synagogue and you look at the rack on the wall of pamphlets and tracts, right? What are you going to see them exercising? What are they going to be all about? What gets them excited? Well, the first item on their agenda, believe it or not, is the centrality of the Bible. Now, this is probably going to be a surprise to most of us. We're not accustomed to thinking of the Pharisees as a Bible movement, but in fact, they were. Now, remember, the Bible at this period was the Old Testament, and that's dominated by the Law of Moses. And they were really big about the Law of Moses because the culture around them had been neglecting it. Apostasy, that adopting Greek ways, had gotten so bad that many Jews started saying that the Bible doesn't apply anymore. We don't have to keep the Law of Moses because that was for an old generation. We've been liberated. We've gotten beyond that childishness. And the Pharisees said, no, we got to get the Bible and bring it back. And they put it back in the center of life, and they put it up on a podium, and they gathered around it in synagogue, and they made sure people listened to it every single Sabbath. They memorized scripture. They did commentary and interpretation. They worked out applications of biblical law to everyday life. They preached it to the people. They wanted Israel to be a Bible-saturated, Bible-obeying, biblically-ordered people. And since their Bible had a lot of law in it, that meant their agenda also had a lot of law in it. Got to obey the Law of Moses. That's the Word of God. And so for them, being a Jew, being a pious Jew, meant living life that is governed in every detail by the law of God. Okay? Translated, a life governed in every detail by the Bible. But here was a problem. The law didn't address every detail of life. So if you're going to be governed in every detail of life by the law, what do you do with those questions that the law doesn't answer? Well, you've got to read between the lines a little and make some judgment calls. You got to exercise some wisdom and prudence and apply that to biblical principles and come up with some guideline, some rule to live by. And that's fine. And as soon as those decisions and those judgment calls that people are making in those gray areas of the Bible, as soon as those things pass from one generation to the next, it becomes what we call tradition. Tradition. And you know something? That's okay. There is nothing wrong with tradition as long as we recognize it for what it is and keep it in its place. That's something the Pharisees didn't do a very good job of. They made way too much out of their traditions. Now, they never, as far as we can tell, they didn't raise it to the level of the Bible. They always held that the Law of Moses held a superior place, but you didn't dare challenge their traditions. You didn't dare change them. Okay? They loved their traditions. They were attached to their traditions. They made a big deal. That's what they were talking about all the time. We also, here, are a Bible movement. We too have a body of tradition. The way we have our worship service laid out, the form of our liturgy, the kinds of hymns we sing, the very use of a hymnal in each one of our hands, the way we dress, the use of this, the use of a pulpit, its central place here on the platform as opposed to somewhere off to the side, its very shape, the use of a piano, the non-use of a choir. And it's on and on I could go. Having a morning and evening service dividing our reading of Scripture between the New Testament at night, or excuse me, in the morning, and the Old Testament at night. Having a long pastoral prayer that tries to pack everything all into one prayer. All of these things are traditions. Add to that formal family devotions, Wednesday night prayer meetings, VBS, Sunday school, and on, just about everything else that we do is tradition, or at least the forms that they take. None of these things come directly from the Bible. All these things have an historical origin somewhere you can trace back in church history to where it got started, and that has been passed down from generation to generation, and it's been inherited by us. This is our religious tradition. And you know something? That's okay. Some of those traditions may be good and helpful. Some of them may not be. Just as it's okay to have tradition, it's okay to change tradition and set it aside and come up with new traditions. Okay? Because the Bible doesn't answer all our questions. So tradition is okay. Let's just recognize it for what it is, and let's keep it in its place. So you have the Bible at the center, and around the Bible in the gray areas the Bible doesn't address, you've got a much venerated, loved body of tradition. And they are really, really attached to that. The Pharisees, like other pious Jewish groups, made a big deal out of the spiritual disciplines. Now, the standard spiritual disciplines or exercises were things like prayer, fasting, almsgiving, doing good, kind deeds, making of vows, dedicating gifts, and so forth. And society had been getting lax in these things. People hadn't been doing their devotions like they were supposed to. People hadn't been fasting as much as they ought to. And so, because every reaction movement emphasizes the things they're reacting against by nature, they emphasized these things. You got to have your devotions just right, and you got to make sure you're fasting on the right days, and you got to make sure, and they got all tied up with this. But they were just trying to be serious about their religion. They were aiming at simply being serious about practical Judaism, applying practical Judaism. The Sabbath was a big deal for them. We know about this from reading our New Testaments. Society had also begun neglecting the Sabbath. I mean, if I could bring it into modern language, they were watching football on Sunday afternoon, going to the supermarket and heading to the beach. And they weren't treating it like the holy set-apart day that Moses had commanded them to treat it as. And so again, the Pharisees are going to emphasize the things that are wrong, that they're reacting against, and so they put a big emphasis on the Sabbath. You got to keep the Sabbath just right. We got to keep it absolutely in every detail. And again, so that requires the development of what? Tradition. Because the Bible doesn't answer all our questions. The Bible says, regarding the Sabbath, that the Jews were not supposed to do any what? Work, right? But what is work? I mean, what did God mean by work? Is it work to cook a meal? Is it work to walk a long distance to a friend's house? Is it work to go fill up a jug of water from the well? What about things that make other people work? Like filling up at a gas station, or eating out at a restaurant Sunday afternoon, or swinging by the store after service to grab some ice cream, you know, to entertain those church friends you invited over. I mean, these are serious, practical, day-to-day questions that a pious Jew and many a serious Sabbath-observing Christian feel that they need answered because they want to obey God. They don't want to break His law. And so you have the need to come up with some decisions, some judgment calls in these gray areas of life. And we laugh at some of the rules the Pharisees came up with. I mean, I could tell you stories that I've heard about Sabbath elevators in Israel today we can come up and just poke fun at them all day, but the fact of the matter is that some of us, at some points in our past and some points in our history, have not always been all that different. The Puritans struggled with this issue in a big way, and to a lesser degree, so have some of us. Tithing was a big deal, too. People weren't tithing properly, okay? And so, what do? You emphasize what's wrong. So the Pharisees made a big deal of making sure that you tithe absolutely precisely, that their tithing was flawless. And again, they had to develop some traditions to deal with the complexities of modern life. But still, they were only trying to be biblical. They were only trying to apply a biblical duty to a complicated life and society in which they lived. The Pharisees were also very concerned with what we could call, for our benefit, church order and worship practice. And of course, by church, you realize I don't mean the Christian church, but I mean the assembly, the gathering together for religious purposes. That would be the synagogue and the temple. The Pharisees were very concerned that these priests were doing their job correctly. And they had all kinds of arguments. Make sure you're purifying yourself the right way and offering the sacrifices in just the right way. And they had a big argument with the Sadducees, we know of, about exactly when should you combine the smoking chemical or compound in with the rest of the incense. When should you do that? Is it before you enter the temple veil or after? And they had a big row over this. Again, they were very serious about how God is worshipped, about the forms of worship. One ancient historical source tells us that everything that happened in Israel having to do with divine worship, prayer, and sacrifices had to go by the Pharisees. They had to do it exactly like the Pharisees directed them to. Their agenda had a big emphasis on the forms of worship and service to God. Haven't we at some times been that way too? Not just our denomination, but a large part of the overall Reformed tradition, especially as it passes through the Puritans and from them has come to us. Now, is there anything wrong with being serious about how God is worshipped? No, you can't be too serious about making sure that God gets the worship he deserves. The mistake comes, and it's a very subtle mistake, when we mistake the forms for the worship itself. That's something the Pharisees had a big problem with. And that's something that the Reformed tradition has at times had a very serious problem with over the years in certain segments. Well, the Pharisees also were the theological conservatives of their day. The Sadducees had gone off the deep end and become liberals. The Sadducees started denying the existence of angels and demons in the spiritual world. They even went so far as to say, there's no afterlife. When you're dead, you're dead. That's it. Not much of a religion. Well, the Essenes went the other way. I mean, these guys were fanatics. These guys were absolutely infatuated with the spiritual. They saw demons and angels everywhere. They were infatuated with the end times, when God would come and the world would burn up with fire and God would... I mean, they were just absolutely infatuated with some of this stuff. And they even went so far as to say that they had some books written by Moses that no other Jews knew about. And I'm telling you, I've read them, or at least the ones that are still in existence, and that's some weird stuff in there. The Pharisees, they cut the middle way. They held to the existence of angels and demons in the spiritual world. They held to the afterlife and the punishment of good, the punishment of the evil and the rewarding of the good. And they didn't go to the extreme of the Essenes and get all weird and crazy and fanatical and come up with books of the Bible that don't exist. So they, the Pharisees, were the sanest, theologically most accurate group in Israel at the time that Jesus came. They were the theologically orthodox. Now, I have one more point here to describe the Pharisees, but before I get to it, I want us to take a look at this list. Centrality of the Bible, love for tradition, spiritual disciplines, Sabbath, tithing, church order and worship practice, theological orthodoxy. Does this list look familiar? With the exception of tithing, probably. Have you ever known a group of Christians that this could just as easily describe? I'm not making this point to bash us over the heads. We have got to recognize the similarity between us and them if we are ever to learn from their mistakes. We've got to be that honest. These are the things they emphasized, and not always, but sometimes these have been sometimes the things that we have emphasized and the things that we've been known for. Now, there's nothing wrong on this list, especially if you're an Old Testament Jew. There's nothing wrong with this list. Some of these things are really good, like the centrality of the Bible. I mean, that's essential. It's not what's on the list that's the problem. It's what's missing. It's what's not on the list. But before I get to that, I'm describing the Pharisees, so I gotta be historically accurate. And there's one thing they were really big on that seems really weird to us, and that is purity. They were Jews. This is a very Jewish thing to be big about purity. And this had to do with the book of Leviticus and Numbers. Remember how many times in Leviticus and Numbers it says, and this will make you unclean, and then you got to go get purified? Well, this is their Bible. So they make a big deal out of this. Ethnic purity meant not mixing with Gentiles, and it's more than you had to. Maintaining circumcision, so forth. Family purity meant questions of adultery and marriage and divorce and women's hygiene and sexual immorality and things like that. But what they gave most of their attention to was what I've labeled food purity. And this isn't just about not eating pork. And we all know about that, right? No, this went a lot further than that. They were very concerned to not contract impurity when they ate their meals. And this, again, comes from the Bible, Leviticus 11. You can read it sometime. It talks what happens when a dead animal or insect falls in their cups and what they got to go through. This is in their Bible, and so they made a big deal out of it. And they thought that impurity, now this is a hard subject for us to get a hold of, so okay, try to get out of our Western modern box. Impurity to them was almost like a physical substance. The best way I can describe it is it's sort of like spiritual germs, and they acted just like physical germs do. They get passed, transmitted from one object to the next by physical contact. And again, where do they get that? Well, it seems to be what you read of in Leviticus and Numbers. Only they took it a little bit further. They had chain passing it, passed on not just from one object to the next, but then on to whatever that object touched, and whatever that object touched, and whatever that object touched. And they're just taking what seems to be biblical, and they're just reasoning it out. And so, Brother Pharisee, you better be careful before you drink that cup of wine over there that you're about to drink. You don't know where that stuff's come from. I mean, the grape harvesters, one of them might have, as he was walking in the vineyard, he might have stepped on an unmarked grave. And the corpse impurity, which was the worst kind of impurity, would have passed through the ground, through his sandals, into his body, and then through his hands, into the cluster of grapes that he reached out and touched to pick. And from there into the wine. And so that wine you're about to drink, it might be defiled. You might contract corpse impurity. And so they were very concerned about these things. So what do? You live in a complex world. There's impurity everywhere. There's Gentiles, there's sexual impurity, there's corpse impurity. How are we going to stay pure? And so they had to develop some traditions, some rules. And so what they did is they came up with a system of washings. Again, based on Leviticus, only they took it further. And they said, we got to wash our cups, we got to wash our dishes, we got to wash our tables, we got to wash our couches. That's where they sat. They didn't sit at tables. They reclined on couches. That's what we're going to eat on, so we got to wash that, right? And we got to wash. And this was not physical hygiene they were worried about. It was spiritual hygiene. It was this invisible impurity that might be attached to what you're eating. They had to go through a ceremony to ritually cleanse it. And again, you know, this is ridiculous to us, but I can see how they can get that reading Leviticus. They just took it a little bit too far. They just made a bigger deal out of it than God did. So that's the agenda. This is what the Pharisees were all about, as far as we can tell. And this was a pretty impressive list for an Old Testament Jew. And there's biblical concerns that lie behind every one of these things. So, what went wrong? What happened. Looking at this on the outside, this isn't a bad thing. This is a good thing. A reform movement opposing worldliness and getting serious about biblical religion. How is it that these people could come to the point where Jesus could say to them, "You guys are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside you're full of dead men's bones and all kinds of uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." The godly were in fact, the godly, you realize, were in fact profoundly ungodly. The pure ones were in fact impure. Not only were they impure, remember what I said about corpse impurity? They're the corpses. Which means they're not only not keeping themselves pure from outside impurity, they're the source of impurity. They're spewing impurity everywhere they go. Everything they touch is getting defiled. This is a complete inversion of their program, of everything that they saw themselves to be. This must have absolutely infuriated them when he said this. These people appeared righteous. They honestly, sincerely believed that they were righteous. I mean, they thought they were doing what God wanted them to do. They thought they were pleasing God. How is it that some people like this can be so wrong about their spiritual condition? Now, as I gather together all the material in the Gospels where Jesus is talking to the Pharisees and try to answer this question, what was wrong with them? How did they go wrong? I can sum up the answer to this question with a very simple statement. The Pharisees did not understand what true godliness is. The only way you can be so mistaken is if you set up an idea, a picture of godliness, and you say, this, living like this, being like this, is what true godliness is, when in fact your picture is all wrong. You get a wrong idea of what it is to please God. When that idea that you have is an actuality, misshapen and warped and distorted, but you think that's what he wants. You think that's what God is after, and so you want to please him. You want to obey him. And so you're going to get zealous about this idea of godliness that you have constructed. You're going to get serious about it. You're going to sacrifice for it. You're going to discipline yourself. You're going to expect others to discipline themselves for it. You're going to expend time and energy and effort in order to achieve this vision of godliness that you have. But if it's not true godliness that you're aiming at, but a counterfeit copy, you're not going to achieve godliness. In fact, you may end up like the Pharisees, profoundly ungodly. You haven't got any time to pursue true godliness. All your passion is consumed with what you think is godliness. It's taking all of your energy and passion and time. To the degree that you focus on this, to the same degree you will lose focus on everything else. The Pharisees were focused on a false idea of godliness, and therefore they were not focused on true godliness. As a result, they were oblivious to the fact that in actuality, they were evil. They were wicked. They had wickedness boiling up and oozing out of them, and they were totally oblivious to it. And that's because all their attention was on how well they're measuring up to their idea of godliness, which was something altogether different than God's. That's how you can be so mistaken about your spiritual condition. Lay hold of a wrong idea of what it is that pleases God, and I guarantee you, you won't. Now, let's dig into this a little deeper. Because I want to know, what is it about the Pharisees' view of godliness that they got wrong? What is it about godliness that they misunderstood? And again, I think from trying to sum up and the gospel material and get down to the very essence of it, I think we can summarize this under two major errors. Two major errors. And this is what this sermon is all about. It's next 2 points. If we get nothing else, this is what I want you to take away with, from here. Because if we can just get this, it will cut the central nerve of Phariseeism in our souls. The first major error is making tradition part of godliness. Making tradition part of godliness. Let's see what Jesus has to say about tradition. Now, the Pharisees saw some of Jesus' disciples eating with defiled, that is, unwashed hands. They found fault. And the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" He answered and said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. As it is written, 'This people honors me with your lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men. All too well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your tradition, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition, which you have handed down." Jesus had a big problem with the Pharisees' tradition. But again, it's important for us to make a vital distinction here. It's not tradition itself that's wrong. In fact, earlier on in the same, well, actually Matthew 23, which is very similar to this, Jesus actually tells his listeners to do what the Pharisees tell them to do. They are the recognized spiritual leaders in Israel. They're the ones who are teaching you in the synagogues. So if they say you should do this and observe this tradition, then do it. Nothing wrong in and of themselves with tradition. Jesus himself observed many Jewish traditions. The problem is when tradition becomes abused. When tradition is abused, then it becomes a problem. And there are two ways, according to this text, that tradition can be abused. The first problem, let's turn back to the first part of this text. The first problem, the first way in which tradition can be abused is by making it binding, making it mandatory. Look at the words I've highlighted in yellow. They found fault with the disciples, which means they expected the disciples to do things their way, to follow their rules, and it was a problem if they didn't. Which means that their traditions were not left in the realm of the optional. They were not under the heading of good ideas, that, you know, good suggestions. They were not kept in the domain of what we call indifferent things, things that you can do and that's fine, or you cannot do and that's fine. That's where tradition belongs. But that's not where the Pharisees kept it. They elevated tradition to the status of mandatory, to the status not quite of the Bible, but you had to keep it. And we can't change. Now, to make this mistake, I'm sorry, there's one more thing he says. He says they taught them as doctrines. They taught their traditions. Instead of being focused on just teaching the Bible in the synagogue, they spent a lot of time teaching their traditions. And they taught them as authoritative, as teachings that every pious Jew has to obey if you want to be a godly person. You want to be godly? Okay, here's the Bible, and here's our traditions. You obey the Bible, you keep our traditions, that's godliness. Now, it's very important that we realize that to make the same mistake that they did, it's not necessary for us to actually say that our traditions are binding. It's not necessary for us to raise our traditions to the level of the Bible. Not even the Pharisees did that, at least not consciously. All you've got to do is treat others as less godly or less serious in their Christian life because they don't observe the same traditions we do. That's all it takes. The social pressure that brings to bear on the minds of people is sometimes as great, if not greater, than if you actually said, "Thus saith the Lord." That has a power to bind the conscience that we cannot begin to understand and appreciate. All it takes is an attitude. All it takes is an atmosphere. A culture that perhaps quietly looks down at others for not doing things the way we do. that treats people as less godly or less zealous or less serious about true religion if they don't observe our customs. And my friends, it's not enough. It's not enough to condescendingly pat other churches and other denominations on the head and say, well, you're serving God too. God's pleased with you. You're doing a good work. All the while harboring in our hearts a smug attitude of pride that still thinks we're doing better. And we can't understand why that people don't flock from their churches and come to our church to do things the way we do them, because certainly they would be serving God better if they did, right? Not necessarily so. Now, there are things that make churches good and there are things that make churches bad. But traditions are not one of them. We do not know that our traditions make us, well, actually we do know, they don't. They don't make us any more holy, any more God-pleasing. They don't make our worship any better than somebody else who has different traditions. This isn't what godliness is. This doesn't make Christians better Christians. The second way tradition can be abused is found in the second part of the text we just read. And we find this in the words, laying aside the commandment of God. You see, tradition sometimes, well, it always has consequences. Sometimes those consequences are bad. Sometimes tradition stubs toes. It causes problems. The error here is that when you observe traditions, you got to sacrifice something to keep traditions. Something's got to be sacrificed. And sometimes people suffer. Because we're so keen to keep our traditions, sometimes we cause people to suffer. And that is a violation of God's commandments, which is to love your neighbor. If you're keeping our tradition is going to offend people, turn them off, try their patience, rob them of joy, leave them exhausted, deprive them of freedom, or put a greater distance between them and God because our form of religion is so unattractive, they don't want to have anything to do with it, then our traditions are getting in the way of God's commandments, which is love your neighbor. He wants us to be loving. He wants us to be serving. He doesn't care about our traditions. He cares about how we're loving and serving and treating other people and doing them good. And he wants us to be willing to set aside our traditions if need be in order to serve people. This is one way in which tradition can easily get in the way of true godliness. If this happens, it's not just distracting us from true godliness. It can actually be a major obstacle to it. And when that happens, tradition has been abused. It has become a problem, and then it has to go. So the first major error of the Pharisees is thinking that it is godliness that pleases God. Thinking that it is godliness and pleases God. That's a problem when you're reading from notes. And pleases God when you're zealous and disciplined and uncompromising in keeping our man-made traditions. That is not godliness. That is a perverse distortion of godliness. Let's not make the same mistake. Let us be known more for our love than we are for our tradition. Let's be known more for our kindness than we are for the strictness of our forms of worship. Let's be known more for joy and genuineness and authenticity rather than how disciplined we are or how much we demand of ourselves and our children because of our customs. God doesn't care about our customs. He doesn't care. That's not where true religion lies. That's not what true godliness is. The second major error the Pharisees made was thinking that godliness is mostly about one's external religious practice. Godliness is mostly about one's outward religious practice. Now, in many ways, this is another version of the previous error. These errors are very closely related. The difference here is that now it's more subtle because we're no longer talking about tradition. Now we're talking about biblical duties, things that God actually commanded in the Bible. Making sure that you obey God in the most, I'm sorry, Even here, in the area of biblical duties, there is a danger that must be avoided. Let's see what Jesus has to say about it. You Pharisees, you tithe, you pay the tithe of mint and anise and cumin, those are spices, and you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guide, you strain out a gnat and you swallow a camel. Now, tithing was not a tradition. Tithing was a biblical duty for an Old Testament Jew. And, of course, the Pharisees had erected some traditions around this biblical principle because life had gotten complex. There were things that the Bible didn't answer, like what happens when you're not sure whether the farmer tithed his produce. And maybe he sold all of it, all 100% of it, to the market. He didn't tithe it. And you're going to go to market, you're going to buy it, and you might be consuming God's portion. So what do you do? Because not everyone in Israel is observant Jew. You can't trust what you buy at the market. So you come up with rules about you have to tithe things when you buy them. So you buy your spices at the market, you better pay a tithe. Make sure God gets his portion. So they take the Bible, they take and they add traditions, but again, they're just trying to work out what they feel is a biblical duty and apply it to complex life. And Jesus doesn't criticize them for this. Notice that Jesus doesn't say you're wrong to do this. In fact, he says the exact opposite. Look what he says. He says, these things, the weightier matters, you should have done without leaving the others undone. You're right to be concerned that God get his portion. You're right to be concerned about biblical duty. You see, the Pharisees' error was not, now this is important, the Pharisees' error was not in trying to obey God in all the details. That was not their error. Jesus said, you're right to do that. The Pharisees' error was one of priorities. Priorities. You see, what they didn't realize is that not every law in the Bible is of equal importance. There are some laws that are really important, and there are some things that are not that important. Now, that's something sometimes hard for us to get our arms around, too, that God would actually do that, but he did. Jesus said he did. Using the words of Jesus alone, what does he say about Old Testament law? Jesus says that there are both motes and beams. There are least and greatest. There are lighter and weightier. There are gnats, and then there's camels. And the person who is obeying the law of God as it was meant to be obeyed is the person putting all their focus on the camels rather than the gnats. Priorities. Emphasis matters. The Pharisees were an utter failure at this. They majored on the minors. They were so utterly consumed with the gnats, with the lighter matters of the law, that they completely neglected the weightier matters. And so while they were admirably precise with the letter of the law, that was good, the things that God really wanted from them, they utterly neglected. Things like loving your neighbor, being full of gratitude to God, conducting yourself with meekness and humility, being forgiving, compassionate, merciful, trusting in God to supply your needs. They weren't pursuing those things. Why? They had a false idea of what godliness was. They thought scrupulous tithing, that's godliness. And you know what? If you're an Old Testament Jew, you ought to tithe. And you know what? Being scrupulous about God's law, that's good. But scrupulous tithing is not godliness. That's not where God lays his emphasis. That's not God's priorities. Well, that's what they made it. That was their priorities, and that was their mistake. And we, too, can get distracted from the weightier matters of the law by emphasizing too much small things. It is very, very easy in religion to emphasize the wrong thing. Very, very easy. Very easy to get our priorities all upside down. Jesus said something else that he said on two occasions about priorities. He said, go and learn what this, and he's speaking again to the Pharisees. Go and learn what this means. Quoting from the Old Testament, I desire mercy. That's loving kindness in the Hebrew. I desire loving kindness, not sacrifice. Now we say, wait a minute, God. You asked for sacrifice. I mean, that's part of your law. So how can you say you don't desire what you yourself asked for? It's not that God didn't want the sacrifice. It's that there's something else he wants much more. He wants his people to be known as to be a compassionate people, full of tender mercies and loving kindness to all. And if they didn't have that, he doesn't want their sacrifices. He doesn't want their worship. In fact, it makes him want to puke. Because there's nothing more obnoxious to God than a religious person who's got a pretty exterior and a rotten inside. He hates that. That's why he excoriated the Pharisees so much. God is not a God of ritual. He's not a God who puts value on externals. He is after the heart. He's always been after the heart. Even when the law of Moses was written, what he really was interested in was the heart. What we do does matter, but who we are matters much more. External religious practice, insofar as it is truly biblical and not just tradition, does have a claim upon our lives. It does. But internal matters of the heart has a much higher claim. That's where we've got to be strong. That's where we've got to dominate. That's where our emphasis must be. If we're failing in that, our worship is meaningless. So let's not fall into these traps. Let's not define godliness the wrong way. So in conclusion, what was the mistake the Pharisees made? Where did they go wrong? They defined godliness incorrectly. They made the mistake of treating tradition as if it were part of godliness, as making them more pleasing to God. Let's not be like them in that. Let's not be like that in our attitude toward the old paths of the Reformed tradition. And even in the realm of biblical duties, or whatever it was that they thought was required by the Bible, even there, they made a mountain out of small details and external religious practice. Let's not make the same mistake. If God doesn't lay stress on it, if the New Testament doesn't make a big deal out of it, then we better not either. And if we do, we're making the same mistake as the Pharisees. And if we make that mistake long enough and happens severely enough, we could end up just like them, ungodly in God's eyes. Remember this? This was the Pharisees' agenda. This is what they were known for around town. Now, several of the items on this list no longer apply to Christians like they did to Old Testament Jews. But of those items that do apply, there's nothing wrong with giving some attention to these things. Certainly, we want the centrality of the Bible to be a big deal, right? That's got to be there, or you have no foundation to build on. So not everything here is wrong. And theological accuracy is important, as long as it's truly biblical and not just orthodox in terms of what has historically been believed. But, you know, we want to be theologically accurate. That's important. But neither of those two things, nor anything else on this list, are what true godliness consists of. You can be stellar in every one of these categories and still be ungodly. Let's not be known for this agenda, except for that first item. Let's be known for that. But other than that first item up there, let's not be known in our community for this. This should not be what people say we are all about. Instead, let's be known for this agenda. This is true godliness. Let's pray. Dear God, please take the items on the list above my head and work these things into our souls by your Holy Spirit. We want to be known for these things. We want these things to characterize us every day of our lives. We want to be like Jesus. We want to have true godliness. We really want to please you as you really are pleased. We don't want to make a mistake. We don't want to pursue the wrong thing, God. But if you don't help us to understand what true godliness is, we're not going to get it right. Please give us your Spirit. Please give us fresh eyes as we open the Bible to see what you emphasize and what's a big deal to you so it can be a big deal to us. And please forgive us. Please forgive us where we've not emphasized the things you do. Where we've made too much of tradition, or where we have put emphasis on minor matters of the law instead of focusing on things that are really close to your heart. We are really sorry where we've done that. We don't want to keep doing that. We want to get better. We want to be more like Jesus. We don't want to have any Pharisee left in us. So please, God, help us. Help each and every one of us. In the name, the powerful name of Jesus, through whom alone any and all change we hope to take place. Amen.